Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's February 1st, 2015, and welcome to episode 93 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. I'm Earl Evans in the Pacific Northwest here on the left coast of those United States of America. And we have quite the international and eclectic cast today. This may be a record on the Retro Computing Roundtable. There are six of us. Yes, our table is hexagonal. So, and we've got, you know, a couple of people here who work at universities, so you'll appreciate me using big words like hexagonal. So I'm going to start out by jumping all the way over to Europe. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Earl.
How are you doing today?
Oh, pretty good. Been bundled up all weekend. We've finally got some actual winter here with actual snow, and it's been a good time.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. And next, I'll throw the lever over to Toronto, Ontario, for Mr. Carrington Vanston. How are you, sir?
I'm fantastic. Hello, Earl.
Cool. Ken, did you survive the blizzard? You and Paul got a bunch of snow dumped on you in that Massachusetts place, didn't you?
Yeah, we survived Snowpocalypse 2015. The state was shut down for a couple of days, and now this Sunday evening we're preparing for round two.
Oh my, I didn't know about that. We'll stay safe.
Thank you.
And now down to where I doubt there's any snow falling. Michael Mulhern coming to us from the land down under.
Well, there's definitely no snow down here. Been a bit of rain, but still it's in the throes of stinking hot summer.
That's what I thought. What was the temperature today?
Oh, it was actually a mild day. It only got up to 31.
Do you have any idea what that is in fake Fahrenheit temperature? I can't do that math in my head.
It's just over 90.
Oh, okay.
I think.
Okay. Well, that's still pretty warm. So what about you, Paul? Is it 90 degrees where you're at?
No, it's actually surprisingly much like where Ken's at. But yeah, we survived the snow, and looking forward to a bit more. Mostly been staying inside, but
I can imagine. Well, I hope it's kind to you guys. Anyway, we've got a lot to talk about today. Another fantastic show, if we do say so ourselves, and we do because we can. I'm going to start with the host topic. I'm going to ask my illustrious panel the question, are we cheating cheaters? That's right. Are we cheating? Because we're retro computer people. But not everything we do with our retro computers is exactly quite kosher retro, is it? I mean, we've got flash storage devices where you can keep all your programs on SD cards or compact flash cards. We have internet modems. We can connect our retro computers to that newfangled internet thing. We've got multi-cartridges, like one for the VIC-20 that's called the MegaCart, that has like every piece of software ever for the VIC-20 on one cartridge. I was hearing the Antic podcast. I was just listening to that yesterday or the day before. They were talking about some Super RAM add-on that'll get you up to 576K. I can't imagine what you'd ever do with that on an Atari 8-bit, but you can do it. And we got LCD flat panels, which weren't even a dream at the time that we had our retro computers. So What's so retro about all of this? And does it take away from the experience? Does it add to it? Is it like a no-op? I'm going to start with the same rotation here that I see in my Skype, like I just did. Jack, let me let you go first. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think there is definitely value in doing this stuff. I mean, in some ways, we have to sort of adapt ourselves to what the modern world has. Like, it's hard to find, if you want to have a nice big TV to plug your vintage video game into, it's hard to find, like, an old CRT model to actually work with stuff. And you kind of have to sort of deal with what you've got. And I think that all these things are ways of adapting to what's available in like what technology allows us to do and doesn't allow us to do. And some of the things are just also adapting to the kind of pace of modern life. I mean, we were content 30 years ago to sit and wait an hour to download a 30K program or whatever it was. But nowadays, you know, people expect it to be able to do so much so quickly, and everyone's juggling 1,000 things that it kind of makes sense to be able to have a faster way to access stuff. And I think that it's instructive to do things the old ways. Like, I showed my kids actually loading a game from tape on my Atari computer. And it, you know, it takes 15 minutes. And then if you're lucky, it actually works. And they were interested in seeing how this used to happen. And I think maybe they felt kind of sorry for me, like, wow, this is what you used to do. But but it's nothing that they would want to ever do again. Like if they had the chance of, okay, I can do that, or I could plug in this thing and maybe, you know, find another way to play this old game in a faster way, there's no question they would never do the slow way. So I think it's you know, it's a matter of adapting to what humans are willing to put up with anymore.
Well said. Kind of retro survival, I guess you could call it, in the new era. Carrington, you actually prompted me to talk about this when we had our chat for my book a few days ago. So I know you've got some thoughts on this as well. And you have a CFFA 3000, as I recall. So you certainly are among the cheaters club, I think.
Cheat to win. I look at it this way. Was the Bionic Man cheating? Was the Bionic Woman cheating? No. They were just better. No, here's the thing. For me, it's about the experience, and an authentic experience can come in lots of ways. I'm happily using emulators as well as old hardware. I prefer to use the old metal, but it's more about the tactile experience. So if I'm on an actual Apple IIe, say, with an actual Apple IIe monitor, but inside there is a CFFA card that's just making it more convenient to use the hardware, I don't see that anything's lost. Is it not authentic anymore? Yeah, but it's more convenient, and I try to find a balance between authentic and convenient, and I like the sound of floppy drives, and I like the look of old CRTs, but they're dying, and if I can emulate a CRT with a Retina screen and not tell the difference, is anything really lost? I don't know. So I see it as not necessarily cheating as much as another way to play with these things, and I'll also point out that a lot of times I'm using hardware that's, say, inside or connected to a retro computer that I wish I had had back in the day. So if it had existed then, I would have used it. It just didn't. So I don't see it as cheating as much as enabling, and that's what I tell myself every day.
Okay. Well, there one really interesting point in what you just said.
There was more than one interesting point in what I said.
There were at least 17 that I counted, but one that I'll pick on. In the 80s, the internet was existent, but we didn't use it as typical consumers. But had the internet been more prevalent, I think we would have had things like internet modems, that kind of thing. Certainly we connected to online systems like CompuServe and BBSs and that sort of thing. So yeah, point well taken. Ken, sir, your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's...
Okay, that's enough. No, I'm just
so
kidding.
Glad I dialed in.
Go ahead.
You want to have a pentagonal table? I'll chop my edge right off. Because that's how it works.
Sorry.
Anyway, I think it's true that, you know, constraints breed creativity, and I think that's a large part of what we enjoy about retro computing. If you buy a new MacBook today, or a Mac Pro or an iMac with, you know, 4 gigs of RAM, and you want to upgrade to 8, you can, because the machine is built to do that. If you want to upgrade your computer, your retro computer, to some higher amount of RAM than what it came with, it's possible that it isn't supposed to do that. It was never designed to do that. Like, the Apple II was not designed to go on the internet and send email over SMTP and IMAP and POP3 and Twitter clients. You know, the Apple II was definitely not designed to use Twitter. And so I think we need to be creative when we come up with these ways to use a retro computer in a modern environment. And I think that's the challenge and the joy that we get out of it. So is that cheating? I don't think at all. I think you are working within limitations that modern computers don't have. And I don't see how limiting yourself can be considered a cheat.
It's kind of the opposite of a cheat in that sense, because you're, like you say, you're having to be innovative with how you adapt that old technology to the new technology. Huh.
Exactly. It's a handicap.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Michael, what do you think?
Well, I'm all for using the new equipment with our retro computers. I'm going to play the grumpy old man card. I hooked up my 2C to its little 9-inch green screen monitor, and the first thing I thought was, how the hell did I do programming on this when I was at university and after that? So the 9-inch monitor has, I'd say, almost been finally put away, and I'm now currently using a 15-inch LCD. Now, that in itself is another problem, because the majority of the LCD screens that we've got these days are widescreen aspect. So it's getting harder not only to find a 4:3 ratio LCD monitor, but also an LCD monitor that will accept an input through even through a converter or whatnot to that display. So it's more of the challenge of hooking our retro computers up to semi-retro, not quite as new out-of-the-box stuff. But it's to me, the experience isn't depreciated by using new equipment. Our machines have slots and cartridges that we use to expand and do more than what the base machine has, and this is just the modern day building on that. We're using our retro machines and we're connecting in the peripherals that are currently available for it. So the machine's 20, 30 years old, but it still lives, so give it some new stuff.
Good point. And the machines had peripheral buses and cartridge slots, like you said. They were designed to be expandable in case there were things that the original design didn't provide. So, yeah, neat. Wow, lots of great thoughts. Paul, top that.
I guess I was thinking that you know, there were good things and there were bad things, you know, in the sort of, you know, vintage computing era. And I'm not entirely sure that, you know, sitting around waiting for the disk to load and all those things were among the good things. So, you know, if it's possible to get this kind of experience, but, you know, sort of filtering out the parts that were unpleasant, that's, you know, that doesn't seem like it's cheating too badly. And so, I mean, I think it is kind of interesting to see, you know, it's kind of a fun project to see what you can do with things that were actually available at the day, you know, even if it turns out you didn't have them, but because they were too expensive or whatever, now you have them, you can do funny things. But, you know, I think it's a hobby now, right? I mean, like before it was sort of much more central to life. This was the computer you used, and, you know, you lived with the disk and everybody else lived with the disk and so forth. But, you know, now you carve out a little bit of time to play with these things, and you don't want to spend that whole time waiting for the disk to load. So, plus also I'm not a kid, you know, so a kid has a lot of time anyway. But so I think, you know, it does sort of allow us to use these things more. You know, we can actually play the games, we can, you know, write the programs and so forth. The things like the CFFA 3000 card and the Apple II, you know, makes a big difference in the availability of sort of archiving tools too, you know, so it's now, you know, relatively easy. There are other solutions too, but it's, you know, using these new connections between old hardware and new hardware, we can now archive things and, you know, save stuff that if we were just sort of copying from floppy to floppy, you know, it'll last for a little while. But, you know, so I am a fan of the connections to the new, and I think it's also an interesting it's an interesting place for challenge. You know, it's what kinds of things can you, what kind of connections can you make? So it is, as long as you can, you know, sort of type on the original keyboard and, you know, see, I think the LCD screen is still a little weird, but, necessary in some cases. So yeah, I don't know. I'm content with my level of cheating if it's cheating.
Well, I asked the question, are we cheating cheaters? And I think the resounding answer is no. And whew, I dodged a bullet there. I'm glad I'm not a cheating cheater. So thank you, gentlemen.
Oh, we didn't say that you were.
Oh, you guys aren't, but I am. I get it. I see how this works. Well, fine. I'm going to go on to listener feedback. So we got an email from Mike McGinnis. Yo, Mike, what's up? He wrote in regarding the discussion in episode 92 about books and ebooks, like this balance between... Was that the host topic for 92? You guys refresh my memory. That was you, right, Michael?
It was me. It's all my fault.
You are the book guy. Mike mentioned that he prefers ebooks for some of the common reasons you can think of, including how much space it takes, and Michael, you can directly relate to that, and also the ease of transport. He can slap a bunch of books on his iPad and stick it in the portfolio and just take it with him. Now, by way of format, sometimes an e-format like Mobi, he says, is better because it'll reflow to the target screen. But if you really want to capture the essence of the original document, what it looked like, then you want a PDF, because that's the whole point of it. It's going to make it look like the original looked. That's often what you want in a retro work, especially, he mentioned something like if it has Waz's signature on it or something like that, or some handwritten notes, or you want to see it like it looked. Also, Acrobat makes PDFs dead easy to create. And there are other tools for PDFs, too. There are tons of PDF tools. So PDFs are easy to make, and they preserve the original format. Now, in terms of where you can get retro books, Amazon can be a good source of retro books in addition to some of the other sources that were mentioned. I will chime in with this. If you see a book on eBay, don't succumb to the temptation of clicking buy it now. First, go to Amazon and a couple of the other used booksellers and see if you can get it cheaper, because it's, we've discussed this on the show before, it's often the case you can get that book for less money on one of the bookseller sites, especially Amazon. I had a Fortran book, it's the one that I learned my first programming on. I wanted to go back and get that book again. So I went on eBay and it was there, but then I thought, let me go to Amazon. Got it for like $2 plus shipping, or something like that on Amazon. So anyway, that's that. Finally, since Mike is the consummate scanner, he's just a scanning machine. And so therefore, since he's got a reputation on that, folks often offer him things like full magazine runs or whatever. And so that's a good source of material too. And Mike, I'll point out, I just picked up 2 years of Compute Gazette, a Commodore magazine, at a local Commodore meeting. So you're right, it's fun to be offered some of the original stuff. So, cool feedback. Thanks, Mike. And now get back to making those other podcasts, would you? Because we want something on our iPod here. Now I'm going to throw it at Carrington, the whole thing. I'm throwing it at you, man. Something about Alan Turing, a timely topic.
Yes, you might have heard of him. Notorious Nazi double agent, Alan Turing. Did I miss
that? Now, wait a minute. I think you totally screwed that up.
Oh, okay. So, of course, everybody knows who Alan Turing is. Everybody listens to this podcast would know. He has some, well, he's dead. Some of his things, in particular a book, a little handwritten notebook, is going up for auction. I thought it was really interesting, and it's timely. It's from 1942, so it's right in the whole Bletchley Park time. And what I think is most interesting about it is it's not really about the Enigma stuff. It's more just him thinking through theories and thoughts and notes, and you can sort of just see the you know, the ramblings of a beautiful mind. And I think it's really interesting. It's going to be auctioned by Bonhams. And I just think it's fab. So we'll have a link in the show notes to, I found a Gizmodo, of all things, Gizmodo article about it. That's where I learned about it. So that's the link I'm supplying. And probably better to head over to Bonhams if you want to see the real details. But it's a neat piece of history and, you know, a neat manuscript from a neat fellow. Probably not actually a Nazi double agent. But I guess we'll find out when we read the book.
Probably not, yeah. Very cool. And Michael, you're just so ambidextrous with your retro computing. I know you're an Apple fan, but you're so kind to bring us news from all over the place. It sounds like you've got some Atari news.
Well, it's Atari news of type. Tony Longworth has released another CD of retro-inspired music, and this one's titled Have You Played Atari Today? Now, we featured Tony's work previously, his CD Memories of Infocom, which I purchased and I thoroughly enjoy that one. I've had a bit of a listen to Have You Played Atari Today, and not really my cup of tea, but it's interesting to see that there are people out there who are creating retro music or retro-inspired music. So if you're after some memories from your Atari game-playing days, pop over to the CD at CD Baby. We'll supply the link. And you can sample the tracks that are on there. And if this is something for your listening pleasure, do yourself a favor and purchase the CD. I'm sure Tony will appreciate it.
I know there's an Atari track that haunts me. And if it starts going through my head, it won't stop for days. It's the theme song from Frogger. I should say the various themes as played on the Atari 800. The music on that, on the disc version, was just fantastic, and we'd play it in our retail store. But once you hear that all day, there's something strange that happens to you. You know, part of which is immediately wanting to buy an Atari 800 for some reason. So might have been something subliminal there. But I love the music from Frogger. I'm sure there's some of the other games that I would love to hear the music from. So very cool. Now, Paul, here's another kind of sound, a paper tape reader, a chug, chug, chug kind of sound, as I recall.
Yeah, so the at the Toronto, what is it, the Toronto Pet Users Group TPUG meeting in December, somebody sort of broke form and brought an Altair. just recently there was a video posted on YouTube that showed, it's called A Retracing of How Paul Allen Loaded Basics on the MITS Altair 8800 from Paper Tape. And so it's a 10-minute video of, you know, toggling in the bootloader, and then there's a little break in the middle where they're going to start the paper tape and the paper tape machine isn't working, and they cut and then they go back and they try to start the paper tape and the paper tape machine isn't working. It's probably very realistic, but so it's sort of interesting to see, you know, just sort of the process of loading 4K BASIC. So that's all.
I saw that video. It was interesting, those cuts that you're talking about. Probably, you know, real elapsed time, 3 hours, 20 minutes, right?
Right.
Trying to get the paper tape to run. That was really interesting. It's a good video. It's fun to watch. I so wish I had a paper tape machine. So there's a fella in the Bay Area that remanufactures, and he's like, famous for being one of the last people who work on the ASR33 teletypes. And you can actually buy an ASR33 teletype from him, and I so wish I had the money. It's not all that terribly expensive. I'd love to have a paper tape punch and reader. It's such a cool device. Anyway, I'm going to talk about something that doesn't have paper tape, a little bit more modern, maybe, a 6502 home computer. Who'd have thought? But this one's home-built from literally the ground up. There's a great article on this. I've read through the whole thing. Love it. On grappendorf.net. We will, of course, have a link up on the show notes. This is a build of a Homebrew 6502 computer from start to finish and includes great technical details on every aspect of this. Like, how do you build the reset feature so that when you turn the computer on, it waits a half a second before it just jumps in and starts going crazy. How do you build the oscillator to give yourself the 1 megahertz clock? how do you connect up the EEPROM and make that separate from the RAM? And if you want those technical details, you can read this. It's actually very well written with great pictures. There's a couple different ways this thing is built from start to finish. One is breadboarding, and then next it goes to actual printed circuit board layout. I can't recommend this enough. And there's other great stuff on this site too, so go visit this. You will be doing yourself a favor. Ken, you're up with Bob Bishop's computer. What happened there?
Well, as we have reported previously on this podcast, Bob Bishop, the co-founder of Apple's R&D division along with Steve Wozniak and also the keynote speaker at Kansas Fest 2011, sadly passed away this past September. The news broke when... It broke to the Apple II community when John Romero posted a message in, I think, late October, early November to the Apple II enthusiast group on Facebook about Bob Bishop's passing. This past week, however, John Romero had an update that was slightly more upbeat. He had gotten a tip from Gary Koffler, previously of Softape, Softape being the company that published several of Bob Bishop's programs, including Apple Talker, Apple Listener, Talking Calculator, and Bomber, that Mr. Bishop's home was being cleared out, and some of the equipment found therein was likely to be thrown away. So John Romero, being geographically close to that location, was able to drive down there and rescue a lot of Bob Bishop's equipment, original Apple II software, hardware, some stuff that he doesn't recognize that he suspects may be either prototypes or just machines that were cobbled together from various parts and pieces. He didn't necessarily have to go dumpster diving. What he did was he saved these things from being thrown into the dumpster in the first place. And I'm very grateful that John Romero and Gary Koffler and the rest of their associates were able to make this happen. I suspect that a lot of this equipment is going to end up at a museum. Two names that were bandied about were the Computer History Museum of Mountain View, California, and the Strong Museum in Rochester, New York. I'm fans of both of these institutions. They're both actively archiving JuiceGS among their collections. And I'm thrilled that we were able to save some of Bob Bishop's legacy from literally the trash.
It is great that that equipment was saved. Good. And we will have a link on that also in the show notes. Great. Thank you very much, Ken. Jack, am I reading this right? Is this new technology that's playing old games?
That's right. So Google apparently owns this tech firm called DeepMind Technologies that is doing AI software. And one of the things that they're doing is software that will literally interpret the video output of a video game, like, for instance, Breakout, and can learn how to play the game and how to play to win. And so basically what it does is they train the AI software by making it play the game again and again. And apparently it has some way of determining, like, what are the good conditions. I guess it can maybe read the score and just notice how long it can last before the game is over. And so it shows how, like, the first few times playing a game, it doesn't know what it's doing. But after it's played for 4 or 5, 6 hours, a few hundred games, it can play better than any human player has ever played at all. So, like, it learns strategy. It learns how, for instance, in a breakout game, there's often a space where if you break through some of the blocks, you can get the ball bouncing up through the top and bouncing across the top to break things without having to bounce off your paddle at all. And it discovers that on its own without having to sort of be taught that that's a good strategy. So there's a video of this showing kind of the results of this thing kicking butt at various old Atari games. And it's pretty cool. And I think this has some interesting implications for, you know, what in the future, what could this do? There, it's a matter of time before they start testing this on playing 3D games, say Quake or Doom, that kind of this style of thing. At some point, it could lead to, potentially, I would think, it could lead to much better bots in games, in modern style games that can actually work as if they were a human player and be better than most human players actually would be. So pretty cool. A pretty fun video to watch, actually.
Cool. Well, I'll get over there and take a look at that. I think the reward-based learning is one of the interesting things about AI these days. Putting a computer in a situation where it tries out a bunch of conditions, learns which conditions are the most optimal, and then learns how to replicate those. It's kind of scary, though. I hope this thing doesn't learn to play global thermonuclear war. That's the...
Let's hope.
That game we won't connect to. No. But Neat. And so speaking of games, as we're wanting to do, Carrington, the invention of the game cartridge, a fascinating story, as I recall.
It is, and there's a really nice write-up on Fast Company about the invention of the cartridge. And there's so much more involved in it that I'd ever really thought of before, because when you're nowadays, you just take cartridges and the idea of a plug-in cartridge is completely for granted. And I even did as a kid. I'd have an Atari 2600, and there's the cartridge, you plug it in, and it works. This article looks at the Fairchild Channel F and the invention of the cartridge and the difficulties in coming up with that when it didn't already exist, when you don't have a model to build upon, and the things that they would worry about, like how will you press a cartridge in and have it hold it in a way that it won't just fall out, but also not hold it in a way that will destroy it when you try to pull it out again, and will that survive children using it, and the decision of the shape, and the fact that they based the general cartridge size and shape on an 8-track tape, because that seemed like something that had survived and people were using it, they understood. And it's funny how you just reach out to the things that exist in the world and say, well, I'll base it on that, and that's why it had the shape it did, and that's why it had the size it did. And there's so many little details that I hadn't been aware of. It's a fascinating article, quite a lengthy one, really well worth the read if you're interested in not just cartridges themselves, but the engineering mindset that goes into trying to come up with a product when you don't really have something to base it on. And I think that's something that has continued, you know, in computing ever since then, and it's something that people keep coming up to. But I found it fascinating. It's got, you know, really neat old photos, and the 8-track idea and a lot of other things were new to me, so I learned a lot from the article, so I highly recommend it. It's a really interesting read.
As I recall, it's a Benj Edwards article, and Benj just does a great job on the stuff that he writes. And also, I wanted to point out, listener Brendan also emailed us on this article, so thank you very much for that feedback as well. I'm just going over here to check. Yep, it was Benj Edwards who made that. Neat stuff. Paul, the Retro Challenge Winter Warm-Up, which I guess they don't actually call it the Winter Warm-Up anymore, do they? But it just ended yesterday.
Right, yeah, the Australian lobby, I suppose. But, I guess, you know... So the month of January was the Retro Challenge. The Retro Challenge, what was it, 2015-01. And there were actually lots of entries. And I sort of looked through the concluding blog posts. It works out pretty much the same way every time. You know, there's a large proportion of the people that went, oh, January's over. But there were just a couple that I was going to point out just because, you know, I noticed them. There were two different things that sort of caught my attention. One was Michael Sternberg did a port of it's sort of like a new game for the Apple II as of a couple of years ago called Structuris, and he did a port of this to the Atari, using I forget what the he used a sort of obscure
PL65, wasn't it?
Yeah, that sounds right. Yes.
Yep.
So he posted a success and showed a screen, you know, a video of it working. The game is basically, the computer plays Tetris and you play a little dot trying to dodge the pieces falling down. It's neat to see that he, succeeded and, you know, it looks good. Another one that I wanted to point out, and I don't know the person behind this one, M.M. Fosis, is the handle, I guess, but this was it was another Apple II one, and he was working on basically vertical blanking and screen splitting stuff, which is interesting, and I kind of focused in on this partly because that was one of the things that I sort of remember Bob Bishop for kind of like pioneering in a way. I don't know if he was the first to discover this, but he wrote a really great article in Soft Talk that I was really impressed by. Soft Talk being the Apple II magazine, which basically went through and talked about experimenting on there's a way that you can read memory that's not really supposed to be read, but if you read it, you can get a sense of like what's being displayed on the screen. You can sort of I don't know, eavesdrop on the video memory. And so he worked out this experiment on how to do the cycle timing so that you can kind of, you know, do an Atari-like thing where the beam gets partway down and then you switch the underlying video, and so you can put text in the middle of the screen this way. And so his was a timing solution. But so the Retro Challenge entry by MM Vosis was sort of experimenting with that talking a little bit about emulators and the tricks. This is a hardware trick, and the emulators don't all do the timing exactly the same way, and so it's also an interesting way to kind of test your emulators. But so I would recommend looking at all of the Retro Challenge result blogs. These two are interesting, you know, among the others, and also Bob Bishop's article is, I think, one of the most influential computing articles I ever read, just because I really like that sort of experimental flavor and getting the machine to do something in 1982 that it wasn't designed to do.
Yeah, using some sort of, if I'm understanding it right, some sort of inferred information. Like, you couldn't read it directly, but you could infer what it was doing. So the tricks folks used to do to get the most out of these retro computers, it's you have to admire the persistence. And congrats to all the people who participated in the Retro Challenge. This is the first time in a while that I haven't thrown my lot in on an entry. I was kind of busy off on a quasi-sabbatical from retro computing while I looked for a job. But now that job search is complete. I'm back in the world, but too late, unfortunately, for the Retro Challenge, so I'll have to wait till summer.
Whereas my Retro Challenge streak is still alive.
Zero participation.
Still a streak. Still counts as a streak.
You have achieved 100% consistency, Carrington. Good job. Ken, something's closing here. Why don't you tell us about it?
Countless opportunities as I get older. That's what's closing. Just doors being shut in my face.
You see yourself passing all of those off-ramps, don't you, and heading for the end of the freeway. Yes,
I know. The sign says, look out ahead, and pretty soon it's just going to say, look out, and over the cliff I go.
But you're not really old enough to be able to say that. I think you're the youngest on the show.
I guess, relatively, I'm not yet vintage. I'm not retro yet. That's true. I'm still the new kid on the block. No, what is closing is, unfortunately, two of my favorite websites. One is relevant to this podcast, the unofficial Apple Weblog, or TUAW. It was founded in 2004 and sold in October 2005 to AOL as part of a conglomerate of websites that includes joystick.com, one of my favorite video game websites. Both of these websites turned 10 years old last year, and this past week it was announced that they are both going to be closing this coming week, either Monday or Tuesday, February 3rd. AOL has decided that they need to double down on their larger websites like Engadget and TechCrunch, and don't wish to invest resources in so-called smaller sites like TUAW or Joystick, which focus on Apple and video games, respectively. Now, why is this relevant to a retro computing podcast? Well, TUAW was not a Mac website, it was an Apple website, and that includes the Apple II. If you were to go to tuaw.com/tag/Apple II, you would find 23 stories that they've reported on in the past year. Sometimes this was retro news that they were just unearthing, like, hey, here's a look at the Apple graphics tablet that Apple came out with in 1979. Sometimes it was newer stuff, like Charles Mangan and all his micro utilities, or rather micro models that he's created, and 3D printing and cases and the like. They reported a couple years ago on the gentleman from Futurama who had some old Apple II software that he was trying to recover, that being David X. Cohen, the creator of Futurama. So all this stuff is just going to disappear. I have emailed Jason Scott and confirmed that in addition to these sites being indexed up the wazoo by the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine, the archive team, which Jason Scott is a part of and which is separate from the Internet Archive, has also been on the case for the past week, and they are going to salvage as much as they can from these sites before they shut down with less than a week's notice. I mean, I think that's disrespectful to the audience who has been enjoying these sites for more than a decade, and it's certainly disrespectful to the staff who have worked so hard on these sites. I know joystick.com recently made a big decision to remove scores and ratings from their reviews going forward, and this was a decision that they deliberated on and spent a lot of time explaining to their audience why they were doing it, and their audience responded very positively to this decision. But this was a decision that they invested all this time in, expecting that there would be a future for them to work in with these new rules, that they'd be publishing reviews, and now AOL comes along and says, nope, in a less than a week from now, you're all going to be unemployed. And so, not only am I sorry for all this content that's disappearing, but my best wishes also to the staff. I hope that they land on their feet in this challenging economy.
Indeed. And we can't always divine the reasoning behind some of the business decisions, but a lot of the time it is disappointing from both a, like you say, a content and a people point of view. I know not too long ago, one of our other magazines and content providers that we've loved over the years, Dr. Dobbs, decided to hang up their hat. But the interesting thing is they did keep the content up there so that you can get to it. They've stopped producing new content, but as I understand it, the old content will continue to be around. And I really appreciate them doing that for as long as they can. There was an article that I saw tweeted, I think it was a CBS News bit on the Internet Archive recently about all the efforts that they make to try to preserve the digital heritage. Specifically, things on the Internet are so ephemeral. They come and go, and you know, if you want to grab them, sometimes you have to grab them today because they're going to be gone tomorrow. But, okay, that's our items of interest and our news for this episode, and now a word from our sponsor.
Hello. I'd like to tell you about Compaq's new Portable 2 computer. It's such a marvelous machine that it would be quite unfair to compare it with another computer. So, we've decided to compare it with this fish. Now, the fish weighs 22 pounds, which makes it extremely portable. It will fit snugly on the passenger seat of your car or when traveling by train on the luggage rack. By coincidence, the computer weighs exactly the same. So, nothing to choose between them so far. But how much can they remember? Well, the Portable 2 has a memory of 4.1 megabytes, a fair old number of megabytes, as I'm sure you'll agree. The fish, on the other hand, can't remember a thing. Hardly surprising, really, because it's stone dead. I expect he could give you a megabyte. Oh, sorry. Anyway, I expect you've been wondering just how much IBM software this fish can run. The answer, I'm afraid, none. The Compaq Portable 2, however, can run all IBM's most popular software 30% faster than IBM can. Ha, ha, ha. So, if you're looking for a powerful portable computer that doesn't smell, we suggest you buy the Compaq Portable 2. Of course, choice. Sorry, I was miles away. Of course, the choice is yours.
And we're back with the host's retro computing gift idea. So, sometimes our retro stuff is called useless, especially by our friends and family members who don't understand it. But I don't think it's useless at all. But the gift idea that I have here truly is useless, other than the entertainment that it provides. It's called Captain Jewel's Useless Box. It's a box that sits there on the table. You flip the switch to turn it on, and a little hatch opens, and a little mechanical finger goes click, and it turns itself off again. It's kind of like a broken retro computer, where you turn it off and it turns itself, or turn it on, it turns itself back off again. But this is more entertaining, because it's actual, you know, a little physical arm that does it. And I think it will surprise your guests. Hopefully it will give them enough entertainment to be worth it. It's $40 in U.S. And I did want to note that there are cheaper ones that you can find on eBay. I can't vouch for them. We do, on our Geek Gift Ideas, like to have links for products to actual online web stores that we believe will continue to be around for a while. Hence, the one that I link to is this one on ThinkGeek. But if you want the same sort of thing, but potentially paying less money, go to eBay, do a search for useless box, and you'll find lots of choices. Anyway.
And probably other things too.
Possibly so.
Or if you can search for, I think it was originally called the Ultimate Machine. So that's some, I remember when I first heard about them ages ago, it was called the Ultimate Machine and then started getting called the Useless Box. So there'd be two ways to search for one. It's definitely a fun thing to build as well. The one I have is one I constructed. It's easy to find kits or just instructions on how to make one yourself. And it's a fun project.
Oh, you have one of these, Carrington?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool. So I imagine people's reaction the first time they see it is kind of entertaining.
Well, the thing is, I have so few things, as you know. I get stuff, I'm like, get rid of that. This thing I have hung on to now for ages, it seems. And it's really fun to have on a shelf because it's got a little switch. And every once in a while, somebody will just wonder what happens. And they press the switch, and the little finger comes up and presses it back. And the reaction is priceless.
Very cool. Well, speaking of other things that you'll buy and then wonder if you should get rid of, why don't you start us off, Carrington, on the eBay auctions?
Well, I have a pair of them. I'm doing a mini Paul, a little mini Paul, two choices. And I am going Macintosh rather than Apple II in this case, because there are two interesting games that I think are available and for quite reasonable prices. The first is, and both of them are factory sealed, so it's an opportunity to release some 80s air. Ooh, I love to do that. So the first one is a still sealed version of Might and Magic 2, which is a game I loved and I played on the Mac. What makes this version, I think, particularly collectible is it's the black and white version. Might and Magic, when it came out for the Mac, came out simultaneously as both a color and a black and white version. And it's much more rare to come across the black and white one, which is what this is. So it's a still sealed black and white one. If I recall, inside the box will come with a coupon to upgrade to a color version if you want to later. Works on System 6. So it's, if you've got an old black and white Mac, here's a fantastic RPG to play on it. The other choice I'm making is also a sealed game. This one I think will go for a bit more. Oh yeah, because the Might and Magic one is, I think, a $20 opening bid, no bids yet, and a $30 buy it now. So quite reasonable buy it now, I think. The second choice, though, is Mac Wars, game I don't see come up very often, also sealed, and it's a very, very early Macintosh game. So this is a game that came out for the 112K or 512K Macs, doesn't work on the XL, like it really only worked on old Macs, and you don't see this come up very often in a still sealed box. So super old Mac game. If you're trying to collect a set of those, this would be one to add to the collection. Opening bid of $19, which I think is quite reasonable for a sealed game that I don't see very often. It's a game that then got ported, I think, to the Atari STs and was really badly reviewed. So I think it might be a game that's more collectible than enjoyable, but still a neat thing. So those are my two choices. Two very old black and white Mac games.
So did they call the Atari ports Dwarves?
No, but they should have.
And an opportunity once again, Carrington, to viciously break the seal on factory sealed things.
I'm tempted on both of these things.
You are the seal breaker.
I am.
That sounds like a porn movie.
It was.
I like the fact that on the back of the box for the Might and Magic, they have screenshots and they're all in color and it says, the screen displays shown are from the Apple II. I almost never see that. I remember always seeing the Apple II games with, like, you know, graphics from the Atari. It was always very irritating.
Well, and Michael is giving a nod to football up here in the States, I guess in honor of the Super Duper Bowl that will be kicking off in an hour and a half. Michael, what do you have for us?
Yeah, well, what I have here is an early John Madden football game. This has been a very long-lived franchise of football games, originally starting in 88 for the Apple II and the Commodore. But you won't be able to run the current versions on that older hardware. But here is an Amiga version. So if you're interested in reliving some ye olde American football, this would be a good game for you. And a very, very low buy it now price.
Excellent.
If you've got £5.95, it's there for the taking.
That actually is a really decent price, $8.94 US.
Yeah, shipping is a lot for me, though. Shipping is three times the buy it now price because it's in the UK.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Shipping is $15 for me.
Yeah. Yeah,
$15 or 15 pounds?
$15.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So it's more for me. It's like 15 pounds to ship to Canada. That seems unfair.
It is unfair.
No, I don't think it's unfair because it's only $15 US to send it to Australia.
Canada's getting shafted.
But you don't,
I'm going to speak to our Governor General about this.
You don't believe in this game. It's not hockey.
This is true. But at least it's one of the not hockeys I've heard of.
Ah, okay.
So, Paul, you only have one eBay auction. Carrington had more eBay auctions than you. Don't you feel sad?
I'll make up for it next time, no doubt. or I'll just talk long about this one. But so what I picked was a Macintosh portable that went up, and it's a fairly reasonable price. It's starting bid at $149, but and shipping at least here within the US is like $26 or something. That's about what these things go for. Partly why I picked this is just because there are a couple of interesting things to talk about these things. This was sort of, you know, Apple's entry into portable computing. This is, you know, before there were really laptops. And, you know, so it's a Mac, with a sort of a fold up screen. I'm sure people have seen these, or most people have. It's kind of neat because it has it's sort of a modular keyboard area. So there's a keyboard and you can have a trackball or you can have a number pad, sort of switching one between the two. If you have both components, and you can reverse them, so you can put the trackball on the left of the keyboard or the right, depending on, you know, which you prefer. So, and these things, they're always plagued by the fact that they only run, they're designed in such a way that they run off the battery. So the power feeds the battery and the battery feeds the computer and the batteries are all dead. So it's difficult to make these things go because the battery's died, and just plugging it in doesn't help. So So what's neat about this particular one is that it's got a new battery. It's also had its capacitors replaced, because that's another thing that this era Mac, you know, is plagued by, is that all the capacitors leak. Carrington, you actually just fixed up an SE30, right?
I did indeed. I just recapped my SE30. It was a fun experience because it worked.
Yeah, excellent. Well, congratulations. But so that's been done with this. And the hard drive has been replaced with the largest 2.5 SCSI device ever offered by Apple. The hard drive on this thing is also kind of a pain, because it's the one that shipped with it has, there's some weird thing with the cable where the pins are sort of swapped around, so you can't just plug in a regular, you know, 40 megabyte hard drive. It's, you know, you have to do some sort of either take the board off the old hard drive to put it on the new one, or, you know, do some other fancy thing. So Macintosh portables are, they're neat. They're kind of a pain. This one works. The screen works. The battery works. It's been recapped. It looks like if you're going to get one and, you know, and don't want it as a fixer upper, this actually is a pretty neat one.
I think the starting price is quite reasonable for a machine that's been refurbished like this. It looks beautiful looking at the photos of it here on the eBay auction. I do have a question, and this relates to a lot of our vintage computers. What happens to the space bar?
I was just going to say, it's so sad that those discolor.
And why do they discolor more than the other keys? It's just so strange. But you've got this beautiful white, you know, nearly factory-looking keyboard here, but a yellowed spacebar. I just don't get it. Well, I'm familiar with the battery thing that you talked about, Paul, because the Epson PX8 computers are exactly the same. If the battery doesn't work in them, you're not going to get them to work, even if you plug them into the AC adapter. It just... And these Mac portables were neat. I had one of these at work back in the day when they first came out, and they are a cool computer. They were cool then, they're cool now. So, neat pick. And what have I got for us? I have a cartridge for the VIC-20. And the reason I picked this, it can be a little bit of a pain to get one of these. Now, there have been a couple here recently on eBay, which is kind of unusual, but this is the machine language monitor cartridge. So if you want to hack around in some machine language on your VIC-20, you don't want to load up a monitor from disk. You want to have like a hardware monitor because that's just more convenient if the machine crashes and that, then you want one of these. But they can be tough to find. And this one has a starting bid of $10. It has one bid on it already with 6 days to go. I wouldn't be surprised to see this go up in price quite a bit. But I just wanted to list this because I want one. I've wanted one for a very long time. But I won't be willing to pay the ultimate amount that this will probably go for. So we'll see. I'll probably keep track of this, and in a week I'll go back and look and just kind of grr and hiss and wish that I had one.
One thing I've wondered about these cartridges for the VIC-20, when you put this in, like another one that you can get is a RAM expander, right? But there's no way to have both, right?
You can with a slot expander. And I had one of those back in the day. The VIC-20 was the first computer I owned, and I was trying to max it out. So it's kind of like a little mini passive motherboard that you put into the cartridge slot, and then you get multiple slots coming out of it, and it has little feet. Now, the thing you have to be careful about is, obviously, your addresses can't overlap and that kind of thing. You have to have cartridges that, in terms of RAM space and such, are compatible with each other. But you could put this machine language monitor and also one of the RAM cartridges in at the same time. That would work. Oh, another eBay auction that I have. This one's closed already, but it was some listener feedback, and I just love this thing. It's a game from Hasbro from the 1960s, and it's called the Hasbro Thinkatron computer. And it's a little toy that uses the concept of punch cards. You feed the question in, and then it gives you an answer. It says, the machine that thinks like a man.
My girlfriends have usually said the opposite of me.
I was just, all sorts of things were going through my head when I saw the machine that thinks like a man. Lots of places to go with that, none of which I will go on the podcast.
It thinks, it answers, it remembers. How is this like a man?
How is this like a man
it
at all?
Remembers. It feels, it cries at the correct movies, it remembers your birthday.
Wow. So, but so cool. Such
it's
a cool
sexist
toy.
Marketing.
Well, it is from the 1960s.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at some of the ads from the 50s and 60s, there's no way they would make it past the drawing room today.
Well, the good news is it's been relisted.
I thought it had sold.
It did not. It got no bids. It just ended, but it's now been relisted.
Oh, if it weren't US $100, that'd be some of the best news I've had all day. But I don't have $100 for this. But wow, what a cool... So if you're listening, and if we publish the podcast in time, you might just get a shot at this. How long does it have to go? Oh, it's a buy it now. So I wonder what happened. I wonder if the original auction got goofed up or... I don't know. Anyway, it's there. So take a look at it. I think you'll be impressed. If you want a 60s era toy that thinks like a man... This is what you want.
Yeah, the original listing looks like it was a regular auction with a starting bid of $100, and it's been relisted simply as a fixed buy it now for $100. So it'll sit there until somebody wants to cough up $100.
Right, which could happen.
Mm-hmm. It's very cool.
Ken?
Earl?
Your turn.
Thank you. Well, this auction is one that...
Ooh, your auction's closing in 46 minutes, 49
seconds. Yeah, can
we wrap
up this podcast, please? I have somewhere to be. So there's been a lot of talk in the past year or two about virtual reality, augmented reality, 3D, stuff like that. We have the Oculus Rift, which was bought last year by Facebook. There's the Google Glass, which we've seen at Kansas Fest. And just last month at CES, Microsoft demonstrated the HoloLens, which looks incredibly exciting. However, Nintendo, as always, was way ahead of the game by decades back in the 90s when they released the Virtual Boy, which was supposed to be their successor to the Game Boy. Well, it failed miserably, and they canceled it after less than 2 years, and it has been on the auction block ever since. Now, I have a Virtual Boy on display prominently in my apartment, and back in November, I had a gaggle of game developers over at my house for a party. And they all saw this thing and said, oh my god, is that a Virtual Boy? We've heard of that, but we've never seen it. Does it work? Can we try it? And I was like, really? I mean, guys, this thing sucked when it came out 20 years ago, and you guys work in the industry. Don't you know that? Haven't you played it yet? So I dusted it off, and I plugged it in, and they each took turns playing it, and they're like, oh my god, the graphics are awful. I have a headache after 5 minutes. I love this. So, apparently there is still some draw to this thing, and you can find them on eBay. There are quite a few on eBay at this very moment. The specific auction I'm listing comes with 9 games, and that is quite the hoard, because there were only 14 games ever released in North America. So this is 9/14 of the total library of North American Virtual Boy games.
A bunch of the games look like they're still in shrink wrap.
That is
well.
True. This lot comes with 2 copies of wow. Red Alarm. However, it also comes with Virtual League Baseball, still in the shrink wrap, and 3D Tetris. Now, this 3D Tetris game, I don't remember the name of it, but there was a version of it for the Apple II. Different developers, different name, completely unrelated, but the same concept, the same gameplay, where you're basically looking down a well, and it's like a 3D cube, and you're looking down the top of it, and you're dropping pieces to try to form complete lines. It was incredibly challenging and not all that much fun, but actually, Mario Clash, which comes with this eBay auction, and may have come with the Virtual Boy, I don't remember. I still dig that game. I think it was a lot of fun 20 years ago, and I still think it's fun. So I recommend, you know, if you ever get the chance to play a Virtual Boy, do so. I don't know that I would spend the $306.42 that this auction is currently going for, but it's definitely a unique chapter in Nintendo's history, and not one that many people have gotten to experience hands-on, apparently.
You know, the interesting thing is, with Oculus going through their iterations of trying to get this right, we still, all these years later, don't have an immersive 3D headset kind of environment for gaming that is just available to the general public.
Or maybe we do, but one of the features is it's so good, it makes you forget you put it on.
Ah, okay. What is the Matrix? Yes, indeed. Ah, very cool auction item. And you can't have the one that Ken listed, because it's definitely going to be closed by the time you hear this
podcast.
No,
Paul will get the editing done in time. No pressure, Paul.
Okay, okay.
You've got 42 minutes.
Paul, you the man. All right. And finally, we have Jack's auction here. And Jack, I'm interested if you could tell me something about this one, too. In the Atari store that I worked at, we typically only had true blue Atari peripherals. We didn't have any of the third-party stuff. So why would I want an Indus GT disk drive over, say, like a 810 or a 1050?
Earl, I'm glad you asked. So the Indus... the Indus GT disk drive. So I actually had one of these, and this was kind of the Cadillac of disk drives available for the Atari 8-bit. So we talked a bit on the podcast an episode or two ago about how the 810 disk drive is this enormous thing that you could, like, if you took the guts out, you could stuff a big pair of boots inside of it or whatever. It's huge. The Indus GT is a whole lot smaller. It's much slimmer, and it actually works with multiple densities. So the original 810 was a single density drive. Atari later had the 1050 they shipped, which was, they called it enhanced density. It was kind of, it wasn't double density. It was kind of like 1.5 times roughly. The NSGT let you do both of those plus actual double density. It had a nice sort of LED display that would show you the current track number. It had buttons on the front for switching between different modes and stuff. And like I said, I actually saved up the extra to buy this back in the day instead of the 810 or the 1050. And it was, in my opinion, well worth it. It was just a really great, great drive. This particular one costs $85 as it's the buy it now price, or $86. And it does not ship with the SIO cable that you need, and it does not ship with a power supply. And the seller says the reason is because these things are heavy, and most people who are interested in this may already have, at least have the SIO cable. But he does say that he has those things available that would be added to the price. Anyway, this is kind of, you know, we started off the podcast talking about the ways that we are using new technology to avoid things like disk drives. And I'm a firm supporter of all that. But if you happen to have, you know, a bunch of disks that need reading in to transfer over to your SD cards and whatever, there is probably no better drive for it than the NSGT, just because it will read every kind of 5.25-inch floppy that was available for the Atari 8-bit.
Nice. Now, how does that compare to a drive that had been upgraded with something like the Happy upgrade?
That I'm not actually sure of. I've heard of the Happy upgrade, but I really don't know what it did. Did it give double density, or was it a speed boost? Or
that's why I was asking. I'm not familiar, but I guess that's some research for me before the next show.
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah, I really like there's a sort of a similar kind of thing that you can get for the Apple II that shows you the track that the thing is currently reading, and that's actually kind of a neat thing if you're trying to figure out, you know, if you're trying to deprotect a disk or something, you know, what is the track it's hanging up on. It also looks like it has a button that you can use to turn on and off the write protect, so you don't have to be like, you know, punching all your drives, and a button that you can generate an error with.
I don't remember the use of the error button. Yeah, it is interesting to look at the display, and you'd think that there would be perhaps an error light, but no, there's an error button. That's the input. Let's make an error. I don't know.
I don't need a button to introduce errors. I can do that all by myself. But, you know, the other thing is, with the cost of disks back in the day, if you could stuff more programs or data onto your diskettes, ultimately, you would save money. So if you had to pay a little bit more for this drive, but if it stored more per floppy, then, you know, kind of like buying an economy car today, you could probably ultimately, like, recoup your investment.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, disks were not cheap. I remember if we could pay $1 a disk for some, like, no-brand, low-quality thing, we thought that was pretty good, because it was typically a lot more than that.
Right.
So yeah, definitely going double density was the way to go.
Yeah, neat. Well, that closes off our eBay auctions. Great picks all. And it brings us to the closing discussion of today's hexagon. And we will start with Carrington. Carrington, what have you got to close us out?
I got nothing. I am the useless machine of podcasting.
I wouldn't call you useless because there's just too many other things to call you. Michael, what have you got for us?
Well, I just thought I'd bring to the attention of our listeners down under, or who are willing to fly down under, that the OzKFest Apple II convention is in Melbourne this year, 17 to 19th of April. We'll include a link to the OzKFest website, so register now if you're wanting to join in for some Apple II goodness and fun.
April is a busy month. We got the OzKFest, we got Vintage Computer Festival East, we got Vintage Computer Festival Southeast. I think also the Cocoa Fest is going on.
Yeah, I don't think any of those are really going to soak up too many of the attendees away from OzKFest.
From OzFest, no, very likely you're right.
But if anyone's up for the challenge and wants to do Cocoa Fest, various VCF and OzKFest, pop down and I'll buy you a beer.
Very nice. That's Australian for beer, mate.
Well, certainly not American for beer.
And Paul?
Well, so last time I promised that I was going to have an interesting thing to talk about by this time, and I don't, but it should be next time that I'll be able to talk about the interesting thing. Sort of meanwhile, I have a sort of a web presence where I put things, and, you know, often there are things like, someday I'm going to scan this set of magazines and, you know, this is where it's going to go. and somebody put a comment on I had such a page for the Portable Companion, which is a Osborne produced magazine for the, that sort of started off with the Osborne One and continued on, sort of a sporadic, magazine. It kind of went and ebbed and flowed with the fate of Osborne itself. But, so I had a comment saying, you know, are you ever going to do this? You know, because it would be kind of neat to see. So I've spent some time going through. I believe I have the entire full run, and I scanned the first couple, and put a couple of the other things up there, and it's been sort of interesting. I don't think of myself as being a particularly, you know, like an Osborne fanboy of any sort, although I'm getting a little bit swept up in it, you know, reading the magazines and all the enthusiasm, and I want to, you know, I have one that I haven't actually, you know, played around with, but now that I'm reading all the stuff I can do with it, I might want to try. Also scanning a couple of, I was sort of cleaning out my bookshelf, so I'm scanning out a couple of, Timex Sinclair section is under the scanner at the moment, so I've a couple of these, you know, weird little programming books with like 101, you know, two-line, you know, 10-line programs you can type into your ZX81 or Timex Sinclair. So, I don't know. I anticipate continuing to do scanning for a bit, and I've done some sort of interesting stuff so far.
I have such respect for the Scaninators, you know, folks like you and Mike and, you know, Kevin Savitz and other people who take out of their busy schedules and scan this stuff and get it up on the internet and save it for posterity. And the Osborne, I think, wouldn't generate possibly as much excitement as some of the other computers because it was a black and white screen and it wasn't traditionally used for gaming. One of the super exciting things that I thought about it back when it came out, because I used to sell them, was this gargantuan pile of software that you got with the thing basically for the price of the computer. And so all the big titles of the day you would get with that thing. I found that kind of exciting back then, but, you know, it wasn't Pac-Man. So anyway, cool. Do you have an Osborne?
I have an Osborne One. It does not have a space bar, but that's the only thing. It powers up. It actually has a modem in it and a serial connection thing. I'm looking forward to playing with it, but haven't done much with it yet.
You're probably lucky, because if it had a space bar, it'd be discolored.
Yeah. Well, it just turned transparent, perhaps.
Oh, that's true. It's actually there. You should try pressing it and see what happens. Ken.
Hey, as we're recording this episode, it is Super Bowl Sunday. The game begins in just about an hour or two, and I want to remind everybody that the Apple II played a large role in the history of football. It was on September 13th, 1980, that computerized stats of a football game were ever recorded, and it was on an Apple II. You can find the details at gostanford.com. There will be a link in the show notes.
Ooh.
That Apple II is still used to record data for the Super Bowl.
You can't get any
they
better, man.
They move slow, don't they? That is awesome.
Yeah, you know, I saw when you posted that picture elsewhere, and I am certain that I have seen that picture. Like, I searched around a little bit earlier today trying to figure out where. There's an article in some magazine, it was probably Soft Talk, but I was unable to find it, that sort of detailed, you know, sort of a couple of different sports applications of the Apple II. But maybe next time, or maybe by the time the show notes are posted, I'll be able to actually source that.
So about 10 minutes from now, right?
Right.
It seems like in 1984, Apple might have done something for the Super Bowl also. I'm remembering something or other, some commercial. That
doesn't ring a bell.
I think they introduced the Lisa.
Yeah, I'm familiar with all the Apple II ads, and I don't recall anything at Super Bowl.
Oh, man. Well, okay, fine. Then I'm going to go over to Jack here.
Well, Earlier, I heard somebody mention Coco Fest is related to the Oz K-Fest. I kind of say it's kind of sad and weird that there's a Coco Fest and there's no similar Atari event. I just feel like...
Why is that? There's a million Atari podcasts.
Yeah,
why
really?
Aren't there any Atari get-togethers? It does seem strange to me, too.
We should be totally on top of this. And I have heard people talking about having...
People are too busy podcasting.
Yeah, everyone's too busy podcasting. I have heard some people talk about going to K-Fest, an Atari contingent, which could be a fun idea. Not quite the same thing, but it could be a start.
Yeah, you know, Kevin and Brad and Randy were talking about that, and I thought, is this a coup? Are they they're going to descend on K-Fest and...
take it over. Now there's an idea. Revolution.
Fun.
Paul, wasn't it you that said that you'd call it Alamogordo or something like that?
Yeah, yeah, and I forget who it was. It was actually Alamogordo was the better one.
They were going to get a little Atari people to come and get rooms in a row, and then they can have like a little mini Atari thing and have their own sessions. It'd be great.
Then you could
corrupt from within. I would attend those sessions.
Give everyone a shovel. You could go, dig a little bit in the landfill. That would be great.
I think that's been done. I don't think there's anything left there anymore.
Oh man. All right, well, I guess I'll land the plane and just close it out to say I'm happy to be back. I was gone for a tiny amount of time, but I'm back. I'm retroing again, and so I'm back to the future and the past, or whatever. And that's it for this show. Woohoo! We did it! All hex of us were able to get through this, and that was fun. So, if anything that we talked about piqued your interest, and I know it all did, you can find the show notes at rcrpodcast.com, not just for this show, for all the shows. You can discuss in the forums at vintage-computer.com/VC forum, and just go now to vintage-computer.com because it's a great forum. You can follow RCR on Twitter. We don't tweet that much, but when we do, it's solid gold. And that's at RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And keep in mind, we are a member of the growing and enthusiastic Throwback Network, which you can find at throwbacknetwork.net. You're going to find all kinds of retro shows over there, not just retro computing, retro this and retro that. If you like living in the past and the future, like I just said, then that's the network for you. And if you like us... Who are we kidding? Of course you do. Please write a review on iTunes because that'll help more people find the show. And it'll just be a good thing all around. Gentlemen, until next time,
Retro Compute!
See ya.
I like retro this, but I'm not sure it's retro this.